This is Culturetopia, a weekly look at NPR's best in movies, TV, books, music, and culture. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, we hear from J.J. Abrams, who directed the new Star Trek movie in addition to being the creator of Lost.
We will soar with the angels and get dirty with the demons in Bob Mondello's new film review.
And we'll hear a little bit about music fans who are falling on hard times and selling their CDs as a result.
But first, reporter Nate DeMeo is going to take us through the phenomena of the pre-show recap, not of this program, but of those other ones on TV. He'll explain why right now there are so many densely plotted, heavily serialized shows on television, shows that require the recap.
It didn't used to be like this. Used to be that the only time a story on TV got so complicated that you needed a refresher to help you out was for one of those very special two-part sitcom episodes.
The Brady Boys never thought their vacation in Hawaii would end up in an ancient burial cave. Then Greg is wearing the idol when he has a terrible wipeout while surfing.
But things have changed, and perhaps nothing embodies that change more than three simple words.
Previously on Lost.
It's funny, television business has changed dramatically in the last few years because serialized shows were dead for a long time.
Carlton Cuse is one of the executive producers of Lost. He says today's viewer has the tools to follow intricate plots that writers just couldn't pull off before. Things like DVRs and streaming video and DVD box sets. We are living in the golden age of the previously on. Shows like Grey's Anatomy and Gossip Girl and Big Love and Desperate Housewives all come with a pre-show primer. Q says that all of the subplots of backstories of subplots of tangents on TV these days can keep a network executive up at night, worried about losing overwhelmed viewers.
While most network executives would acknowledge that it's impossible to catch the audience up, they feel like they can't just abandon trying to do that. So they put the previously on, you know, just in some hope that if you just are watching on the network, you're going to be able to kind of follow along.
In the first couple of seasons of a serialized show, the previously on typically serves the new viewer. That person who's heard good things about a show but could use a scorecard to tell the players apart.
Previously on The West Wing.
My name is Sam Seaborn, and I'm the Deputy Communications Director.
I'm Josh Lyman, Deputy Chief of Staff.
But by a show's third and fourth and fifth season, all pretense of catering to the lay viewer is set aside. Damon Lindelof is another executive producer on Lost.
At this point in the game, the previously on is just to satiate the sort of, oh yeah, contingent, so that when you're watching the show, you go, oh yeah, that's why Jack's so angry. Oh yeah, that's why Saeed has just melted out of the jungle with the gun.
Lindelof says he thinks of previously on Lost as the equivalent of his wife sitting down right before the show starts and asking him what he needs to know. He's only got 30 seconds to tell her. But you can say a lot in 30 seconds.
There's a scene where Faraday is explaining why he's going to try to change the time stream with the hydrogen bomb, and that was actually a 6.5 minute long scene. We can actually reduce it down to 2 lines. We can name that tune in 7 seconds.
And just how exactly do you plan on destroying this energy?
I'm going to detonate a hydrogen bomb.
That's all you need to know.
He says there are pitfalls to previously ons. If you're watching Lost or any other show with a recap, and suddenly there's a character you haven't seen in several episodes, you're just not going to be surprised when they show up in the middle of this episode. Jeff Alexander is the author of The TV Guide to Life. He says for the most part, that just adds to the pleasure of watching the show. It's a tease. But sometimes...
Previously on 24.
It's a spoiler.
The funny thing about 24 is they always have these sort of freeze frames introducing an individual character. Now, if it's a character who hasn't previously gotten one, like if it's a minor character like someone's boss or coworker, there's a pretty good sign that that person's going to die that episode.
Lost season finale airs tonight. The network has been hyping it as a special 3-hour season finale event. It's not. It's a 2-hour season finale. The first hour is a recap of what's happened this season. It's a giant previously on. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
Linda, this is something you know a thing or two about, and in fact you wrote about it on NPR's blog Monkey See.
I did. I wrote about it this week. It's interesting. The creators of the show, I think, have said before that it's not aimed at casual viewers, that you can't really be a casual viewer. It's gotten far too complicated. As early as the beginning of this season, I had written that I still liked the show, even though I did not always get a chance to see it, and I had missed a fair amount. I still felt like I got a lot out of watching it, even though you miss nuances and things like that. Now, end of the season, It's this season, it's over. You can't watch it that way anymore. The previouslys are no help. The recap shows are no help. There's so much folding of time and mythology. And this was the season where I just said, it's impossible. It's probably a good thing, because that's when you get a certain amount of complexity and things like that, when they're not trying to constantly provide new little doors into the story for people who don't know anything about what they've been doing for seasons and seasons.
So J.J. Abrams is a guy who created Lost, and he has this love for the intricate that he seems to bring into almost every franchise. And so he appeared on Talk of the Nation, and one caller called in to ask him really about another TV show that he's been involved with, Fringe, and to ask him about some of the mysteries that he's noticed in the commercials for Fringe.
The truth is that, you know, while I enjoy puzzles, what I enjoy more is sort of, you know, the idea of compelling ideas and stories that that require the audience to fill in the blanks. It's not puzzles per se, but it's the idea that a story presents a question that you may not even be aware that you're interested in, but there's something about, you know, a story that asks the question. It can be as simple as in Star Trek, for example, when we meet young Kirk, we know he's going to be captain, but he's hardly a captain at the beginning. So it could be as simple as that. How is he going to earn that captain's chair? What's that adventure going to be? It can be more specific, which is how are they going to kill the shark in Jaws? It could be whatever it is, you know, an overt mystery, a whodunit. I just love stories that force the audience to lean forward and to kind of look into the screen to try and figure it out. So that's to me my approach. Puzzles are sort of a more literal way of you know, equating that to, you know, everyday life. But in stories, that's my favorite thing.
It's interesting because he talks there about requiring people to lean forward and pay attention to mysteries. He also talked a little bit during this appearance about leaning forward in terms of looking at the relationship between a story that you're telling and things that are really happening in the real world.
My favorite show of all time was The Twilight Zone. And one of the things that Rod Serling did so brilliantly is take issues that mattered to him, politics, race, you know, important social issues. And he got into such trouble with the networks and the sponsors that he finally decided to turn, you know, his attention to science fiction, which would allow him to tell the stories he cared about safely. While we didn't overtly try and make, you know, Star Trek into some kind of, you know, political treatise, we wanted to make sure that we were telling a story that felt relevant and valid. And so, yes, there's clearly, you know, issues that I think there are clearly issues you could draw parallels to. But the most important thing about Star Trek for me is it's an optimistic story. It's a world that is, you know, it's our future, and it shows collaboration across political, racial, cultural lines, even interspecies. But the collaboration is what will save us. And that, to me, is a wonderful message and very refreshing after many, many years of dark, post-apocalyptic, cynical futures.
And you can hear the full interview with J.J. Abrams at our website, npr.org.
And speaking of dark, cynical, apocalyptic things, let's go to the music industry.
California's Amoeba Records is the world's largest used music retailer, and the company is finding trade in used music can be a buffer in bad times, both for the store and for customers who are selling their old albums. April Domboski visited Amoeba's San Francisco store.
The checkout lines at Amoeba Records usually wind deep into the clearance aisles, but not lately.
Next, please.
These days, the real action is across the way, at the counter where Amoeba buys used CDs. As cash gets tight, people seem to be scavenging their racks for something to sell.
The dump is on, if you will.
Tony Green manages the San Francisco Amoeba.
We're getting people bringing in just bags and suitcases and just bulk. They're just selling everything.
Gabriel Stricker came with 400 CDs. An Amoeba buyer offered him a surprising financial insight.
He's like, I could have told you months before any of the economists or anything that the economy was going into the dumps, because instead of the spare change from under the sofa, they basically were looking around their house for anything that they could convert into cash.
People were selling so many albums, the store was becoming an ATM. Amoeba had to cut back on the amount of cash it could pay. The used CD market is booming in the Northeast, too. CD sellers have been streaming in to Newbury Comics in Boston, unloading their Celine Dion and Red Hot Chili Peppers albums.
We'll see 20, 30 people a day that will bring in, you know, 5 to 20 CDs or 5 to 20 DVDs.
Sarah Fee works at the Faneuil Hall store. She says about 75% of their sellers are motivated by the payout.
We hear a lot of sob stories, unfortunately, people that need money for bills or just need money to live. A lot of people are hurting and would like the money.
Back in the Bay Area, Amoeba has been buying so many UCDs, the extras are piling up in its Oakland warehouse. Tony Green comes twice a month to drop off the surplus.
System disarmed.
And we're in.
Boxes and boxes of CDs are stacked on pallets along the floor.
I would say there's probably about 60 pallets.
At 6,500 CDs per pallet, that's nearly 40,000 CDs. Amoeba will sell some of them during the summer tourist season. They'll ship the rest off to other stores in the U.S. and abroad. Peter Wall came to Amoeba to sell some of his old punk CDs. He started feeling a cash crunch when the bookstore where he works cut his hours. Then his car broke down.
I mean, it was paycheck to paycheck at that point, and then that just put me under.
He's looking for another job and selling books and CDs for extra cash. He saves it all in a cat food dish in his room until the first of the month.
Rent. Everything goes towards rent.
For other sellers, parting with a collection that took a lifetime to curate can be quite emotional. Gabriel Stricker compares his CDs to grains in an hourglass.
And then you basically go into a store and turn it upside down and just like evaporating away. And that was kind of my experience, was just sort of like watching the sand of this hourglass just like going away. I want to tick, 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 tick.
Amoeba's buyers are sort of like bartenders. They bear witness to the stories of each CD. Stricker sat for an hour and a half while the buyer cataloged his beloved collection, including the first CD he ever bought by James Brown.
Instead of just like dropping them off and having them be gone, I could actually sort of process it with them. It was just like slowly letting it go.
Stricker's not strapped for cash. He plans to spend his entire payout on more CDs. For NPR News, I'm April Demboski in San Francisco.
Well, our producer is just outraged by this entire story. He's like, when's the last time you ever played a CD anyway?
Well, that's the thing. I think you have to wonder realistically. People talk about giving up their collections and it's very emotional. But I, you know, realistically, I wonder how many of them are giving up very much that they haven't burned to a hard drive or something like that. So I don't know. I'm curious about several aspects of that system and how it works. As we all know, one of the big things about culture, looking for the artifacts. And we actually had a piece this week about a very interesting, very old piece of art that was discovered. It's a figurine of a woman carved from mammoth ivory. It dates back 35,000 years. And they believe it may be the first representation of a female figure ever found. And it's evidence, they say, of early symbolic expression among humans. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
It stands a little less than 3 inches high, a remarkable find given that it was buried among debris in a German cave for 35,000 years. The figure is blatantly a woman with exaggerated sexual characteristics, large breasts and buttocks and explicit female genitals carved into the ivory. It is strongly reminiscent of well-known Venus figurines that date back about 29,000 years, thought to be symbols of fertility. Paul Mellars is an archaeologist at Cambridge University in England who studies early art forms. He says there's no way to tell whether it was carved by a man or a woman, but it's part of a tradition of rendering human forms in a sexual way that is as old as, well, apparently 35,000 years.
But at the end of the day, of course, sexual reproduction is the way that society keeps itself going. If there hadn't been this massive interest, if not obsession, with sex, the human race would have become extinct.
The figurine was found in a cave, along with tools and other signs that humans had spent time there. There are works of human craftsmanship that are older and are arguably art. One in South Africa dates back over 70,000 years, but it's not what archaeologists call representational. It's essentially geometric designs drawn on rock in ochre. But then prehistoric art started to get more sophisticated. Cave painting in Europe started to appear about 30,000 years ago. These showed animals as well as geometric designs. Mellar suspects the figurine predates them, but is part of an explosion of symbolic craftsmanship in Europe that's gone on ever since.
We've got such a clear pattern now in Europe that a whole range of these things explode onto the scene by at least 35,000 years ago. That's at a associated with the dispersal of the first modern human, Homo sapiens.
From that same period, archaeologists have found beads and pendants and the first flutes and a lot of sexual representations of female and male anatomy. Neanderthals, the closest relatives of modern humans, were still living in Europe at the time, but Melar says he thinks the female figurine is too sophisticated to be anything but the work of Homo sapiens. And there's evidence the figurine may have been worn on the body. It doesn't have a head, but instead a carved ring, so that it could have been worn on a cord. The discovery was first reported by archaeologist Nicholas Conard from the University of Tübingen in Germany in the latest issue of the journal Nature. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
They're always making us headless, Netta.
When the Da Vinci Code came out in 2006, it racked up $750 million at the box office. That's despite receiving mixed reviews and offending some Catholics. Our critic Bob Mondello has this review to the sequel, Angels and Demons.
You'll be pleased to know that since Harvard symbologist Robert Langdon did all that anagram solving to chase down the Holy Grail, he has slimmed down a bit. As played by Tom Hanks, Langdon now swims laps every morning at 5 a.m., which is what he's doing when a representative of the Vatican shows up, clutching not an anagram, but an ambigram, a typographical rendering of a secret society's name, Illuminati, that reads the same whether you look at it right side up or upside down. Well, Langdon knows what that means.
Someone is trying to make you believe the Illuminati themselves have returned to Rome, right after the death of a pope.
Four cardinals were kidnapped from their quarters inside the Vatican sometime between 3 and 5 a.m. this morning. Shortly afterward, that document was sent to the office of the Swiss Guard, along with the threat the cardinals will be publicly executed one per hour beginning at 8 p.m. tonight in Rome.
You'd think this would prompt a call to the police, but the Vatican works in mysterious ways, and apparently without a fax machine, so they sent a guy 3,000 miles to Massachusetts with the ambigram because they know Langdon will know how to get right to the point.
Why me?
Your expertise, your erudition, your...
Oh, for heaven's sakes, you were in the first movie. Now get thee to the Vatican and be prepared to deal with more than four kidnapped cardinals. There's a beautiful biophysicist named Vittoria Vetra in the Swiss Guard's office because a canister of potentially explosive antimatter has been stolen from her father's nuclear lab and because nobody, but nobody, ever goes to the police.
Antimatter. We need to locate it immediately or evacuate Vatican City.
I'm quite familiar with incendiaries, Miss Vetra. I've never heard of antimatter being used as such.
Well, it's never been generated in significant quantities before. It's a way of studying the origins of the universe, to try to isolate what some people call the God particle. But there are implications for energy research.
God particle?
Did I mention that the cardinals who have not been kidnapped have locked themselves in the Sistine Chapel to select a new pope? Perhaps only Dan Brown could leap from antimatter to anticlimax so quickly. But as is generally the case with him, there is so much else going on. So Langdon risks his life looking up Galileo at the library, while Vittoria heads for, well, I'm not sure I remember where exactly, maybe to talk with Ewan McGregor, who is simultaneously trying to persuade the cardinals that they're not at war with science and that science is trying to kill them. All of which gets a bit thick, but that's okay because it gives the stars time to go racing around Rome to see which way statues are pointing their fingers, because the Illuminati, that society that's kept secrets for centuries, would never indulge in misdirection about where they're going to kill cardinals, right?
This is the first marker. The path is alive.
Presumably in response to criticism that the Da Vinci Code was static and talky, director Ron Howard has made Angels and Demons frantic and talky. He's gotten quite good at making statues look threatening and catacombs claustrophobic, and when it comes to murder in the cinematic cathedral, he may now be Hollywood's go-to guy. That said, there's only so much he can do with Dan Brown's idiotic plotline or the fact that the pro-science Illuminati, anti-science church stuff doesn't really make sense. Nor, I should note, do claims that the film is somehow anti-Catholic. You won't find any incendiary controversies in Angels and Demons, though at one point a cardinal goes up in flames entirely persuasively. I'm Bob Mondello.
For more reviews from Bob Mondello, go to the movie section of our website, npr.org.
You know, Netta, I wanted to mention, with regard to Angels and Demons, Tom Hanks was on The Daily Show last week, and he had a wonderful little interview where he told a bunch of great stories, one of which is a fantastic little bit about antimatter and a story he learned about the creation of antimatter and why it didn't last after it was created. And we'll make sure to have a link to that clip at npr.org/culturetopia, where you will also find links to all of the other stories that we heard today.
Well, we've had a podcast full of puzzles, ambigrams, and glyphs. Angse Orfe Orningus J on Ultratopia this week. I'm Netta Ulavi.
And I'm Linda Holmes.
Talk to you soon.